Canada, we call ourselves the True North Strong and Free. It's a great slogan, but with most of our population huddled along the American border and most of us never having been north of our respective regional cottage country areas, are we really a northern country? Hello, I'm Brian Lilly, and this is the Full Comment Podcast. Before we get to our next topic and guest, I'm going to ask a favor. Hit the subscribe button on whatever app or device you're listening to us on, and that will ensure you get notified when each and every episode comes out. And please remember, share this with your friends, your families, post it to social media. Help spread the word. Now, when I say the North, what comes to mind? I live in Toronto. It's on the 43rd parallel, well below the 49th that we often use to describe and identify our border with the Americans. Around here, people talk about going up north and they mean to the Muskokas, Toronto's cottage country that's actually well south of Sudbury. I calculated the furthest north that I've been, and it's a place called Waskasoo, Saskatchewan, which sits at 53.92 degrees latitude north. It's north of Prince Albert. It's just a smidge more northern than Edmonton, but still, it's pretty south compared to the Arctic. I'm not trying to belabor this point, but my experience is pretty common for many Canadians. So are we truly a northern country? Do we pay enough attention to the Arctic? Lots of countries are paying attention to that region of the world, and we better start to do so as well. Heather Exner-Perot is a senior fellow and a director of Natural Resources, Energy, and Environment at the McDonald Laurier Institute. She's also a global advisor for the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and a research advisor to the Indigenous Resource Network. Thanks for joining us today, Heather.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you're someone that spends a lot of time thinking about, talking about, writing about the North, writing about the Arctic. As a country, do Canadians pay enough attention to the Arctic?
Well, there's different ways to think about it. From a policy perspective, from a security perspective, I would say no. There's lots more we could be doing, should be doing. For the average Canadian, I think there is a sense of northern identity that some other countries wouldn't share. The United States wouldn't have that same identity, even though they have Alaska. Even for Denmark, I think Greenland is much more remote for the average Danish person than it is for Canadians. It is fundamental to our identity, but as you say, most people haven't been there. We don't have great strategy. We don't have great implementation in that area. So there's lots more to be done.
How far north have you been? I'm guessing a lot further north than Waskasoo.
I have been to all 8 Arctic countries. So the 5 Nordics, Alaska, I've been to Siberia, I've been to Yakutsk. And then I've been to all 3 territories and I've been to Greenland. So yes, I've done all of the, but I'm a social scientist. So I usually go to the capitals. I don't go on the land and study tundra or anything, but I've been to a few of the national parks further north.
There was recently a report from the Senate, and most Canadians, when they think of our government, don't think of the Senate, but they do good work. And they've issued a report called Northern Lights, a wake-up call for the future of Canada by the Special Senate Committee on the Arctic. They do say that we've got to worry about sovereignty in the Arctic, especially with the Northwest Passage opening up, other countries being interested in the resources that are there, having very different views of how those resources should be extracted, if at all. How do these changes that are happening in the North play into our Arctic sovereignty strategy, if we even have one?
Yeah, so in Canada, we often think of the Arctic through this sovereignty lens. And it's probably not the most policy pertinent lens, but it's kind of been infused in our national consciousness. So there is the issue of the Northwest Passage. Is it internal waters or an international strait? And notably, we disagree with the Americans on this, but we've pretty much agreed to disagree. And even since 1988, we had an agreement that we implemented with them. And so it's a well-managed dispute, essentially that the reason the Americans don't want to recognize the Northwest Passage as Canadian internal waters is because they're afraid that would set a precedent for other international straits, like the Strait of Malacca or Strait of Hormuz. So it's not so much about the Northwest Passage, it's about freedom of navigation in general. And so, so in general, they say, okay, we won't challenge you there. You don't push it too far either. just so we don't compromise other areas. So that's the one thing. Then there's also this extended continental shelf. So under the Law of the Sea, which was passed in 1982, countries can claim, their 200-mile exclusive economic zone. Everyone has that. But if your geology extends quite a bit further, you can go up to 350 miles or more. In essence, this means that the entire Arctic seabed is open to division between Canada, Denmark, with Greenland and Russia. And so we are negotiating how far does our extended seabed go? How far does the Russians go? We aren't agreeing, obviously, but it's not a place that we think we're going to go to war over. Hopefully not go to war.
Hope not.
I just want to say, Brian, because the last territorial dispute we had was one Hans Island. And we actually figured out a negotiation. We negotiated that and solved that particular sovereignty issue with Denmark just a few months ago. So we have made progress on that one.
I remember back to 2010, ancient history now, it seems. China's then president, Hu Jintao, was coming to Canada for a state visit, first one in 35 years. That was the earlier one. But he was showing up in 2010, and around that time, there were interviews given by senior government officials to Chinese English language media, obviously directed at sending a message to Canada. And they were making noises that, well, China has 20% of the world's population. Therefore, they should have 20% of whatever is in the Arctic. And they have a very different view of how the Arctic should be treated. Is there more to our view of why sovereignty matters and why we want to ensure that we have some control over areas in the North? Is there more to it than just the United States in the Northwest Passage when you've got Russia looking to make the Arctic waters a year-round international shipping zone, when you've got countries like China or Russia wanting to go in and do resource extraction in ways that we wouldn't approve of?
Right. So with regards to the Chinese, that was a provocative statement they made. And the context was very different around 2008, 2010. That was at the height of the last commodities super cycle, commodities boom. And everyone was looking for resources everywhere. And a lot of commodities had their record price levels at that time. If you remember, oil hit $147 a barrel. And at that time, Arctic resources looked like they might be economic, that you could actually make money by developing them. And then the commodities down phase hit and we had a bust. And so Arctic development really hasn't occurred at any kind of pace in the last 10 years because commodity prices have been so low. The Chinese at that time, made that provocative statement, said they're a near Arctic state and wanted to view the Arctic as the common heritage of mankind. So it's kind of this international zone. And I mean, obviously the interest for them is that, then they have equal access to from everyone. That's not a Canadian interest or American interest or Russian interest is the interesting one, or Nordic interest. But the international law is pretty settled around that, like I say, with the Law of the Sea, exclusive economic zones, and the extended continental shelf. The one wild card is fishing. In international waters, a lot of these things beyond 200 miles, it is, the extended continental shelf is only the seabed. So if you wanted to do undersea mining, not the fishing. But actually, about 3 years ago, there was an Arctic fishery agreement, a moratorium on fishing in the Arctic, in the central Arctic Ocean. There's no fisheries now anyways, because it's so cold. It's not a great place for wildlife. So it was an easy agreement to come to because no one was fishing there anyways. But China, Korea, the European Union, Iceland, Canada, United States all agreed that we would not fish there until we understood the fisheries better. So in that respect, China was playing ball on the one area that, they might have be able to independently go in the Arctic is on fishing.
So if a sovereignty lens isn't the right way of looking at it, what is the right way of looking at the North? It's a sparse population. And one that is not overly prosperous, one where living there is incredibly expensive. I mean, we've all seen the photos of what it costs to buy what we would consider basic foodstuffs in the North Mart. But all of that needs to be shipped up. Do we need to look at it from a perspective of of making sure that there's a decent quality of life for the people that live there, empowering them, going to an economic model that works for people in the North?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's that community lens, like you're alluding to, and I can talk about that. There's also a security lens separate from sovereignty. So sovereignty is, you know, do we have control? Is it ours? Is it undisputed? It is. And yet it's still a very vulnerable area for hypersonic missiles and things like that coming from Russia and China. So that's why we need NORAD modernization. That's why we need to have, you know, domain awareness. You know, when a Chinese weather balloon comes over, we need to know that it's coming months in advance and be able to take it down. So there is that security issue I can talk more about. On the community side, though, and it's an important conversation, is, you know, it is the most sparsely populated. We have the least population density. The Canadian Arctic is mostly the coldest, the most sea ice infested, will be the last to melt. And all these things make it more remote, more difficult to develop than the Nordic area and even most of Russia. Some of Russia is obviously just as difficult as Canada, but not all of it. Alaska still has warmer currents, is more easy to access. So the Canadian Arctic is very different in that way. The port of Anchorage has year-round access. Port of Nuuk in Greenland has year-round access. But in Canada and our Arctic, they'd be, you know, ice infested. You might get a 3-month season. So it is more remote. That makes it more expensive. There's only 110,000 people in our three territories. So there's lots we could do, but it'll always be expensive, it'll always be difficult. The secret sauce, economically, from my perspective, obviously is resource development. And actually right now, 99% of the territory's exports is mining. But there's more that could be done. Obviously now we're looking to have, you know, friendly sources of critical minerals. There's not a lot of infrastructure there, so it makes it cost prohibitive for miners to invest there, to develop there. There's not always social license. So there's lots we could be working on to enhance the resource development, make it more competitive, and then get those ore and source revenues and those jobs and that training to Northerners.
There was a real emphasis in some ways, critics would dispute it, but in some ways from the Harper government. And there's been less of an emphasis from the Trudeau government, at least in terms of gestures, like Stephen Harper would take an annual trip to the North. When the United Nations was trying to determine boundaries, they took a very different tone, saying aggressively trying to say, well, here's why we believe this territory belongs to Canada. Trudeau's view was leave it to the experts. Aside from tone, though, has much changed in how the federal government, which is ultimately responsible for the Arctic, territorial governments do have some responsibility, but I would argue the federal government seems to be a bigger player. Has there been much difference in terms of policy between the two governments now that we're 8 years into the Trudeau administration, or is it just a matter of tone and emphasis?
So it's more than tone and emphasis. I would say that there's been a real lack of ambition from the Liberals on the Arctic, from both a domestic and a foreign policy perspective. You know, if I were to give them good marks from something, you know, the Inuit-Crown relationship seems to be stronger. There has been money put in. But from a security and from a foreign policy perspective, almost nothing. So they did develop their own strategy. The Liberals was the Arctic Northern Policy Framework. I think it was 2019 that it was finally approved. And it was a long consultation process. It was what you might expect from the Liberals, you know, where they had, you know, all the territories, all the Indigenous groups, couple provinces, even Manitoba was consulted. I think there was 25 stakeholders that were consulted. And the document is very much just a consensus of, you know, these are the things that we find important. And there was no real leadership. It was more like, you know, the federal government guided the process, but didn't want to lead anything, didn't want to presume to lead, you know, Northerners on the North. But that leaves a real vacuum, is that for someone outside of Canada to look at our Arctic Northern Policy Framework, it's very dilute. It's not very ambitious. It's not very concrete. It's not very practical. There's not a lot of guidance. It's a plan to plan. It's a framework. It's not a strategy. And that starts to show. You know, and so when we're dealing with something like, you know, the need for critical minerals exploration, like Russia invading Ukraine and changing kind of the balance of geopolitics, there is no guidance and there's no strategy really on what Canada is going to do through the Arctic to address these things. And so, you know, the big story in the op-ed and why I'm here this week is my op-ed in the National Post is, while Trudeau was invited to meet with the Nordic leaders in Iceland, special guest, it's quite an honor. It means something that it was a Canadian prime minister was invited. At the same time, we closed the Canadian International Arctic Center in Oslo, which was set up in 2009, kind of the last time the Arctic was big in geopolitics. And you know, our one senior Arctic official is also responsible for Europe and Eurasia. Just imagine that. In Canada, we lump under a single diplomat Arctic, Eurasia, and Europe affairs.
It's
preposterous. It's preposterous.
Yeah, it's a pretty big area. Even just Eurasia or all of Europe, that's a pretty big area. Now, I did want to ask you about the closing of that center. What was it, and why was it in Norway? Why did we not have our own center on the Arctic in Canada?
The thinking behind it is to have some presence in the region. Again, are we an Arctic leader? Are we a G7 nation? Do we want to provide some thought leadership and some concrete, practical security leadership in this area? And if you do, then you should have some presence on the ground, and you should get to know the stakeholders and the partners and the issues and be seen and be present. So that was the thinking at the time. I don't know that the center itself it certainly wasn't as effective as it could have been. And so maybe, you know, if I'm being generous, maybe that's part of the reason of why it would close. But the solution in my mind wouldn't be to close it, it would be to make it more effective. That, you know, right now in 2023, our presence in that region on the northern flank of NATO with our Nordic partners, as the Arctic Council is flailing a little bit because Russia is a member of it. This is a very important time for us to be there with our Nordic partners, to understand them, to reassure them, to be a support. And we seem to be doing the opposite. And again, it's this lack of ambition, a lack of seeing ourselves as an Arctic leader, and it's certainly a lack of being an Arctic leader. And it's, you know, of all the places where Canada should lead, should be stepping up, you would think the Arctic would be it. And we're doing exactly the opposite.
In your op-ed in the National Post, you did mention Melanie Joly, Canada's foreign minister, going on, I believe it was CTV's question period, and in saying, you know, we want to increase our influence in the world. That's something they've been saying for 8 years now. And I would argue that by trying to be involved in everything but not committed to anything fully, perhaps I'm being unfair, rather fully committed in Ukraine, but they decided that Canada should be part of everything, but we're not focused. And I would say that has watered down our influence in the Arctic being part of that.
So I absolutely agree. And I think that's consensus. And the fact that Joly is saying, oh, we want to increase our influence shows at least that they're acknowledging that we haven't been influential, that we are laggards. And we're having, you know, all of our allies saying in back channels and in leaks that we aren't stepping up in NATO and how surprising it is. You know, with all of our, you know, that we aren't stepping up on the energy side, on the resource side, on the Arctic side, on the NATO side. You know, they have a war on their border. And we're still sitting here so complacent about everything. So at least Joly is recognizing, you know, that this is what's being said. Our allies are looking for more, and we should start doing something. You know, it's 8 years too late, but at least it's happening now. It's been 18 months since the war in Ukraine started, and now we're trying to, you know, figure this out. A little late, but so yes, we absolutely need to do more. And it's not a mystery, what do our allies want from us? And it's the agenda of Biden when he came to Ottawa in March. What were the things the Americans wanted to talk about? Again, NATO, our 2%, NORAD modernization, energy and resources, getting critical minerals and energy out to our allies. So it's not a mystery what they're looking for us. And now, you know, can we start to do something about it? And the Arctic holds a key to a few of those things. It holds a key to continental defense through Nordic modernization. It holds a bit of a key through NATO because it's the northern flank with Russia, yeah, and Sweden and Finland joining NATO, where a lot of the activity is happening, where some of the new, you know, vulnerabilities are being exposed. And then it's critical minerals. It's one of the last great geographical regions where there is untapped critical minerals that we could start tapping. And we need it not only to get off Chinese and Russian dependence, but to have this energy transition. So here is an area that purpose built for Canada to lead in. But again, it's like we're just discovering that this region exists now in 2023.
Well, I've been listening to politicians talk about the Reign of Fire for longer than I'd like to admit. It's been at least 20 years, if not more. And the Ontario government, mostly I've heard about it from various incarnations of the Ontario government going back to when Ernie Eves was premier, Dalton McGuinty, Kathleen Wynne. Now we've got the Ford government, and they appear to be making some headway. They've got the two closest Indigenous groups leading an environmental assessment to look at, can they go in there? Can they build the road? Can they begin to extract the minerals that are there, the critical minerals? And while everyone says this is incredibly important, you've also got the federal government questioning it from an environmental standpoint. And so there seem to be mixed signals about what we can and should do. I doubt that is something that is very helpful in extracting these critical minerals that you're talking about.
So I think Canadians should know that we actually extract fewer critical minerals in 2023 than we did in 2019, and in many cases less than we did in 2005. So we are very much going the wrong way if you think critical minerals are important to our economy, to the energy transition, to our security. We are going the wrong way. And so again, like you say, since 2015 until the Ukraine war, there was very much a sense, and Bill C-69, the Impact Assessment Agency, kind of institutionalized this, that we want to move away from resource extraction. The Prime Minister said, you know, at WEF once in Switzerland, we want to be known for our resourcefulness, not for our resources, and that, you know, our young people should go and do university and white-collar jobs, and that the future is not in resource extraction. And now here we are, you know, climbing back from that, saying, wow, actually, we do need these critical minerals. Our allies are asking for it. We need more energy. We're facing energy crises. We'll face some more. And what can be done? And so at least on critical minerals, we've heard a change of tone. We have a critical mineral strategy. Provincial governments like in Ontario are trying to push this forward faster. We're building battery plants that rely on these supplies. So rhetorically, there has been a change of tone. But in practice, all of the difficulties on the regulatory side, on the permitting side, on the financing side, on the international and competitive side, none of that has changed. And so now they've committed in budget 2023 that they're working on it. They have a task force. They expect to have some reforms by the end of the year. But there isn't really confidence in industry, I would say, from all of my many conversations, that they know how to unwind what they've just spent 8 years implementing. So it'll be a tough road for sure.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right now. But when we come back, I want to ask you about the differing views. You know, you've written about the Americans taking a renewed interest in the Arctic, the reasons that Canada should take a greater interest due to how things are going with Russia. But I want to get into a bit about the different viewpoints and how those countries are looking to either play in the Arctic, extract in the Arctic, exploit compared to what we're doing. Contrast that with what Justin Trudeau said at the WEF that you mentioned. Back in a moment. Heather, when I was looking at different articles preparing for the interview, I found one in India. I was just trying to find out how many clear sailing days do we have going through the Arctic Ocean. And, you know, when you see articles in Canada about being able to sail the Northwest Passage, it's often accompanied with, oh, this is bad, this is going in the wrong direction. I found one out of India celebrating the ability of Russian mariner traffic to spend more time, to have a longer shipping season, and how great this was. There really are different views out there on whether what's happening in the Arctic is a good thing. Where are we compared to the Americans, compared to the Russians on things like that, using the Arctic as a shipping route?
So the Russians are in a class of their own when it comes to the Arctic. They have half the territory, two thirds of the people, three quarters of the GDP in the Arctic. And the Arctic is so much more important to Russian politics, to the Russian economy, than it is everywhere else. And the statistic I like to use is, depending on the price of oil, the Arctic represents probably 15 to 20% of Russian GDP. It's huge. the Canadian territories, far less than 1% of our GDP. Alaska, far less than 1% of American GDP. Greenland is far less than 1% of Danish GDP. So we are really looking at apples and oranges. That said, you know, we have a lot of the territory. Why are the Russians so far advanced? One is, you know, they put the state policies and you know, forced people there into Siberia for a long time. But also because the Northern Sea Route is a better route than the Northwest Passage. It is open for longer, and they have the warm current that goes all the way to the Barents Ocean, all the way to where most of their natural gas is. So we have seen an incredible LNG boom in Arctic gas in the last probably seven years, and it's continuing. And one reason is because it is almost ice-free all through the year from where they're, you know, from Yamal, from where their, you know, big reserves of natural gas are in the Arctic Ocean, all the way to Europe. So almost all their natural gas, their LNG has been going to Europe. Now they have to pivot, obviously, that the Europeans are still importing record amounts of Russian LNG, but trying not to. And so the Russians are looking in the medium longer term that they need to go to Asian markets, to India, to China, and others. But that is the ice choked way. That is the far more difficult way. So the Russians have invested in these heavy icebreakers. They have, you know, far more nuclear icebreakers than you know, anyone else, almost combined. To give themselves the opportunity to export their goods from the Arctic to Asian markets. So they are working on that. In Canada, almost nothing is happening. And one reason is that the Northwest Passage is a far, you know, a far worse sea route, and it always will be. So like I said before, it is the last sea ice area. It is ice choked for longer. It will be the last one to melt if we ever see ice melt for the summer season. It always refreezes because it tilts at 23 degrees and the winter is 6 months of darkness. So it'll always refreeze. It's also narrow and it's also shallow in many parts. So it's a very...
And going through a lot of islands and straits that the Russians just aren't dealing
with. Exactly. They have if you look at, you know, the top of Russia, it's pretty much a straight shot. So even the ice break, you know, and it's not easy. It's never easy to ship in the Arctic under no circumstances, but it is so much easier on the Russian side. And that's why the Northern Sea Route is so much more developed. On the
American, we did have plans for our own icebreakers, and I don't think that's ever come to fruition.
No, well, we do have icebreakers, and now, you know, so the one thing the Harper government did is you know, launch the Arctic Offshore Patrol ships. So I think we have three in service now, three more are coming, and the Coast Guard's probably going to operate too. So we have increased capability there. We have increased some monitoring capability, satellite capability. So it's not as if nothing's happening. And also appreciating how difficult it is to operate in the Arctic. The Canadian forces are very good at it. And we have the Canadian Rangers, which is, you know, primarily Indigenous kind of paramilitia that obviously have incredible intelligence and an understanding and experience with the land that train our Canadian forces. We have some, you know, kind of mutual learning between them. So we have advantages in that respect. So when people say, for example, oh, China's going to come to the Arctic, no, they have almost no competence operating in such an environment. And when you're up there in the Arctic, it's about survival. You know, let alone, there's no occupying, there's no taking over territory. It's trying to survive in that territory long enough to achieve whatever your mission is. So that's why we don't think there'll be a hot conflict in the Arctic, is because as a military theater, it is so difficult. It's you know, the hypersonic missiles passing over it is the real concern.
Why the re-engagement by the Americans? Is it political? Is it economic? Is it just a change in administration?
That's a great question. So you know, for a long time, the Arctic was not, even though it was important to Canada in the 90s, at the same time that the territory of Nunavut was being developed as the 10th, we had many land claim agreements with Inuit. So it was important in Ottawa. And we are conceiving of ourselves as this northern nation in the 90s. And we were the ones that pushed the creation of the Arctic Council. And the Americans were very, you know, agnostic about it. They really needed to be pushed. They only agreed because we said we won't discuss the military. It won't be a treaty-based organization. You know, it's just a forum for talking. And so that's how the Americans were convinced. But then, you know, again, it's the commodity cycle that hit, you know, in 2008, 2009. The Russian flag planting at the North Pole in 2007 that re-piqued their interest. And now it is, you know, again, they're an American superpower. Norgard, you know, the continental defense is more important. The critical minerals are more important. The oil is more important. Russia's making a lot of moves in the Arctic to develop it. And so that's brought them in. And so they have a new strategy as of last October. They're creating a new Arctic ambassador role. Mike Sprague is going through the nomination process. They've opened up a consulate in Tromso. They're making so many moves while Canada has been standing still for about 10 years.
In terms of energy, energy usage in the north, there is a push on several provincial governments that started with New Brunswick, Ontario, and Saskatchewan. I think Alberta's joined in now on trying to facilitate the use of small modular reactors, small nuke plants that could be placed somewhere like northern communities. How important is that sort of policy when you consider how much is run by dirty diesel generators in the north?
Yeah, I think there's about 170 communities in Canada that are diesel dependent. And in Nunavut, for example, they are all 100% diesel dependent. Yukon has some hydro and Northwest Territories has some hydro, but they're also very diesel dependent. And when you look at mining up there, they're almost all diesel dependent too. So, you know, some of the diamond mines, I know, will take 85 million liters of diesel a year to run. So just think of that. So and they're starting to age. A lot of them were put in the 50s and 60s and they're starting to age and they need to be replaced. So we don't want to replace them with diesel. So for me, you know, we talk about the SMRs and we talk about, you know, kind of the on-grid stuff happening in Ontario and Saskatchewan, New Brunswick. The far more exciting application for Canada are these microreactors that are combined heat and power and can do the job that diesel does, not only for communities, for clean energy, then you're not dealing with black carbon and the pollution that comes from that and the noise and the other, you know, and the climate change impacts, obviously, but also, you know, a secure, they only need refueling every 7 or 8 or 9 years. They're very safe. You can bury them. And you can mine. So all of a sudden, here's an opportunity where we are going to be able to have energy for the mining, energy for the communities, and also energy for the military. So it's like a trifecta, these microreactors, because when you're talking about the enormous amounts of data, of monitoring, watching the NORAD facilities need, microreactors can provide that. In fact, the first microreactor going in Alaska is at an air base. U.S. Air Force base, because it makes so much sense. So I am so excited about the prospects of microreactors provide cheaper, reliable, clean, affordable energy for so many different purposes that we don't have right now.
Speaking recently with someone who's working on energy security for northern communities, and they are speaking to people in places like Sweden, they were until the invasion, speaking to people in Russia and dealing with the Americans in Alaska. And they said that we are just so far behind when it comes to providing cleaner energy, and that they were just in the Yukon. And you mentioned the noise, and that may sound trivial, but when you've got a constant din of a generator behind you, that does have an impact on you. Now, plus the particulate matter and everything else that goes with it. So that's an interesting angle. To circle back as we close then, we've got policies and we've got talking, and the phrase that you used about the government's plan, a plan to plan, that sounds like the most government thing I've ever heard, and unfortunately far too common in many areas. But you've said that we could be a superpower in this one area. Canada is not going to be a superpower in the world, at best middle power, and only on some points. Not even on all points can we be a strong middle power. But make the case for why we need to be an Arctic superpower.
Well, because it's one area where we can lead. And so it's important to us, you know, we have a huge amount of territory. You know, we do have Canadians there. We do have experience and the struggles and challenges of remoteness that many, you know, few other people have. But it's more to the point of what is Canada's role in the world and what can we contribute? And the Americans are taking up a pretty big burden on a lot of angles here. and would like to share that burden with some of their closest allies. And here is Canada tailor-made really to provide the thought leadership, the innovation, the strategy on the Arctic. And why do I know we can do it? Because we were that person. We were that country in the 1990s that provided, you know, new arrangements with Indigenous peoples on the governance side. We are the best at remote mining, that we do know, you know, how to operate in that environment so well, that we did lead thought leadership on foreign affairs in that region. So we've done it before, and for whatever reason, we let it fall by the wayside, and there was a huge vacuum, and now the Americans are having to fill the vacuum. But they have other things that they could be thinking about. So for me, it's just, we're a G7 nation. Where can we best contribute? And for me, the obvious answer is the Arctic.
We shall see if the government is listening to you and listening to this Senate report and others who are making some very good arguments. Heather, thanks for the time today.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Full Comment is a Post Media podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Prue with theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Libin is the executive producer. Remember what I told you at the start. You can subscribe to Full Comment, so hit subscribe. Whether you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Amazon Music, hit the subscribe button. Listen through the app or your Alexa-enabled devices and help us out by giving us a rating, leaving a review, and tell your friends all about us. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Brian Lilly.